International students nurture dreams of making it to a competitive U.S. college. If the chances of being accepted by an elite U.S. school are 1 in 20, then international students have a 3x steeper hill to climb. Hello and welcome to this episode of College Matters, Alma Matters. Benjamin Stern is the founder and CEO of Ivy Achievement, a college counseling firm based in the U.S. Ben channeled his Ivy League background into counseling to add value to students in India, Vietnam, and beyond in their pursuit of competitive colleges like the Ivy League. Interesting fact, Ben gave up law to pursue college counseling. And no, Ben doesn't regret giving up law. To hear about this and more, let's go over to Ben Stern. So Ben, let me start by welcoming you to our podcast, College Matters, Alma Matters. Really appreciate you making the time.
It's great to be here.
Sure thing. So as I think we chatted, the audience is really, you know, all college-bound students. We are particularly focused on students, international students, who are looking to apply to the United States. And we've been focusing on Asia and the Middle East, at least at this point in time.
Sure.
But obviously anything, these kind of conversations are beneficial to just about anyone. So with that, I just thought we could start off by talking about your firm, Ivy Achievement.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit about what you do and some history. That'd be awesome.
Sure. So I started Ivy Achievement 5 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
I had left a job as a lawyer in California. I had actually moved out to California with a law firm.
Uh-huh.
And then I left my job. It wasn't for me. Left my job actually a few months later. And I needed to pay the bills, basically.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I knew that college counseling and college essay editing was something that you know, people would pay for.
Sure.
And so I started helping people online. I saw on Reddit, some Facebook groups, people really needed help with their essays. So I started doing essay reviews.
Uh-huh.
This was in October, November timeframe,
uh-huh.
Doing essay reviews and then charging for essay editing. I had some publication experience, writing
sure.
experience. I'd done very well in my writing, my verbal SAT and writing SAT. And I went to law school, so I had a lot of writing experience, and
uh-huh.
And students found that I was adding value. I was helping to add value. I did a full cycle
uh-huh.
of applications and had some pretty good results. Students got into NYU, USC, one
uh-huh.
even got into Harvard,
uh-huh.
who I had helped, and you know, I realized that this could be a scalable business.
Yeah.
So I decided to get together a board of advisors
uh-huh.
to help me to basically to put on my website. I created a website with a brand.
Uh-huh.
I chose Ivy Achievement. Not sure it was the best choice, but now it's a recognized brand. We're going to stick with it for the time being.
Sure.
Then I started to look for funding, and I was first putting together, I was planning to put together a board of advisors and then look for funding after that.
Yeah.
So somebody that I had somebody who I wanted to be on my board of advisors. And, he was a friend from law school. We had, we were casual friends.
Sure.
And I wanted him to be on my board of advisors. I asked him if we could get together for brunch. He was living mm-hmm. in New York at the time.
Yeah.
And, we had brunch and I, was telling him about what I was doing and, you know, I was telling him that a lot of the students that I had helped were in India and there was a really strong demand in India
uh-huh.
for this kind of thing. So I was telling him that, you know, it would be really great, you know, to go to India and, you know, do marketing there. And, you know, I had this, you know, vision for, a scaled business
uh-huh.
and, you know, he asked me, he was a pretty successful entrepreneur, and he asked me, "So how much money are you going to try to raise?" And at that point, I didn't know.
I was
just still putting together my board of advisors, and then going to come up with a business plan. And I told him I didn't know. He said, "Well, you should figure it out." I said, "Like right now?" He said, "Yeah, sure." And we were at brunch. I literally did math on a napkin, how much I was going to need for, her marketing to hire, somebody full time for travel.
Yeah.
And I came up with a number, and he said, "I can make that happen."
Wow.
And it's not like he wrote a check the next day, but I ended up getting a few investors together. He helped get a few investors together, and, they funded Ivy Achievement for our first year, for the first business efforts. And so a few months later, I was in India. In my first trip to India, I visited, I had one person working full-time for Ivy Achievement and one person I hired just for the trip. This is my first ever trip to India.
I get
into Delhi. That day had a high of, I believe, of 46 degrees.
It was
during heat wave in 2016. This is 2016. So the first year I did this was 2015, 2016. This is 2016 in May.
Yeah.
Hottest time of the year. It was quite an experience. Delhi, Mumbai. We visited Delhi, Mumbai, Lucknow, Jaipur, Hyderabad, Calcutta, and Chennai.
Wow.
The very, very first trip to India.
I know. It was a grand tour then. You got all the
hubs. Was.
Yeah.
It was. And we had events. We visited schools. We were able to promote it and get a lot of attention. And we were able to pick up students from each place. And by then, we were pretty well known. I was pretty well known, even after the first year. And we had students came from Chandigarh to Delhi.
Yeah.
One of them ended up being a very successful student. He got into multiple Ivy Leagues. So fast forward a bit, I've been back to India several times since then. I visited several of the cities.
Yeah.
Primarily, I visit Delhi and Mumbai each time.
Yeah.
But I've also been now to Bangalore since then.
Yeah.
And Chandigarh as well. So in addition to those cities, I've been to many cities in India. So we've assisted students in India and also Vietnam. I had another business contact in Vietnam that started an Ivy Achievement division in Vietnam. So we have operations there as well.
Fabulous.
I went a little long on this.
This is fascinating. This is fascinating. I mean, the motivations and then how you get going and what's the rocket fuel here, really important. Thanks for sharing. I mean, that's really, really interesting. And so here you are. So obviously, this is 5 years now into it, right? About roughly.
Yeah. And if I can add, I want to add that it was really important. I thought it was really important to visit those places because I really got a sense of a diversity of Indian families, certainly families, both ethnic, socioeconomic, attitude in English speaking and attitudes towards in politically, really, really a wide diversity of families. And it was really important to become attuned to the culture, in India. And I had really very little knowledge. I had one Indian American and one Indian working for me, but very little knowledge, and got a lot of experience very quickly.
No, that's, I mean, absolutely. I mean, your feet on the ground, nothing like understanding the customer. Do you do students? I mean, are you counseling students in US as well, or are you just focusing on India and Vietnam right now, or where are you today?
We do have students in the U.S. I've had a few families, a few students. We have families and students in the U.S. who just use our SA services because we have an online, we are a full-time counseling component, and we also have an online essay submission component where students can submit essays, get reviews, get edits of their essays. So we have more American students through that channel. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more competition in the United States, and it's a pretty saturated market. So I decided to focus on the international market. But we do have students in the U.S. and most of our students in the U.S., not all, but most of the students in the U.S. are referrals or are referrals from families in other countries. So Vietnam and India, often ethnically, they are relatives or friends from India or Vietnam. And they're the first generation immigrants, and the kids are sometimes second generation immigrants. They were born in the U.S. So they are American citizens and pretty American sounding and typical American high schooler, pretty much. But their parents happen to be from another country.
Got it.
So second generation immigrants and first generation immigrant families.
What are the types of students that you end up counseling? I mean, just in terms of what grade do they start? How soon? How early? And then how do you go about that?
Sure. So if it were up to me, students would start in, ninth grade, eighth grade even. But families aren't often coming to us or thinking about it by then. Uh-huh. In general, we start with students who are in 11th grade or in India because the school year begins in April, April, May, sometimes as early as March. We're helping them sort of in the beginning of their 12th grade mm-hmm. Is often when they come to us. And we have families who have been working with us since as early as ninth grade and currently, some ninth grade, 10th grade families as well. Generally, they'll come to us in 11th and 12th grade and we'll start working with them then. And the way we structure it is that we have guidance in 11th grade and then they can choose from a selection of packages depending on how much help they need later on. So we try to be flexible and try to offer the most value. In terms of the kinds of students, in India, it's mostly two things. Mostly students who are interested in computer science mm-hmm. or students who are interested in commerce and business. Mm. They're interested in business and finance and broadly economics if, they're targeting schools that don't offer a business administration or finance degree.
Got it.
But they're interested in going into business someday. We do have students who are interested in other things in either in addition to or instead of students who are interested in the biological sciences, psychology. Other social sciences are pretty rare besides economics. And psychology. But we have students who are broadly the two big categories of the computer science and business.
Got it. So roughly... So you start somewhere around the 11th, typically. You think you'd love earlier, but 11th is when it starts. And so by that time they've kind of, it's a little too late to shape their extracurriculars. So it's probably mostly about helping them through the application process, right? I mean, if you're in the 11th.
Yeah, well, we sometimes, depending on how early in 11th, we can do a sort of an intervention to focus on extracurricular activities.
Okay.
We certainly can. And a lot of the college application process is about spinning the extracurricular activities as much as it is about amassing a resume.
Yeah.
But we do help students in the process, and we come up with a success plan. Trying to cover all the categories of extracurricular activities that they need, where to bolster their application, where necessary. If they already have their testing done, it's easier for them to spend time on extracurricular activities.
Sure.
But we do help them hone and sometimes what not to do is as valuable information, valuable advice as what to do.
Yeah, I agree. So a couple of things. So obviously nowadays you're not visiting. You don't have people on the ground there, right? This is all done over video calls and all the interactions, correct?
Well, we do have somebody on the ground in Delhi. She's in Delhi. She was living full time in Mumbai, but she moved back with her family in Delhi.
Okay.
So she will meet with families. She will. Well, before the COVID, she was meeting with families, and so I do have somebody full time there, and she will always travel with me when I'm there. So I do have somebody on the ground. We don't have a full time office now, but we do open an office when I go visit there. So we do have ground operation right now with COVID. Everything's been online.
Okay. Okay. How big is your team right now? I mean, roughly.
So we have right now, I'm the full-time counselor, and we have, I have one full-time person that I just mentioned in India.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then we have various other specialists who we call in as needed. So we have writing specialists right now, a team about four or five writing specialists who are active and ready to work with students, who already have, some of whom have already started working with students.
Yeah.
We have an athletic advisor who helps out with our student athletes. So he's he has his own athletic consulting service, and we contract to him. So he's part of our team as well. And right now we're onboarding some for interviewing, especially for business school. Interviewing is an area of demand we're looking at.
So one question that I've been just thinking about here is, you know, you're dealing with students in India and Vietnam. Just as a matter of course, how, you know, what are the differences between these students? I mean, what do you find different? Obviously, each country and each region probably has its own strengths and weaknesses, but how would you characterize them?
Sure. Well, before I get into that, I will say that we have students from many other countries.
Okay. So, broader. I mean, that would be even nicer if you give us just sort of a broad feel for it. Yeah.
Yeah, it happens to be mostly NRIs in other countries. So, and we've had NRIs in Bahrain and in the UAE, in Indonesia, Singapore, and then we've had students from Hong Kong, other countries as well.
Yeah.
I had a student from Kazakhstan last year, two years ago. Student from Belgium, for who is applying to graduate programs. So we have a lot of different countries, but have been Indian community and Vietnamese community. It's a very good question how they're different.
Yeah.
So I find that, first of all, in Vietnam, the parents very rarely speak English. In India, usually the parents will speak English enough to be able to communicate. They're often more comfortable in their mother tongue.
Sure.
But it's easier to communicate with the families. So in Vietnam, we have a team that communicates with the families in Vietnamese. Generally, the communication with our families in India is done in English.
Yeah.
Families in India have usually a better idea of the admissions process.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot more of the big thing is that in India, there are a lot more opportunities for extracurricular activities generally. Mm-hmm. And we're getting students who are more involved in extracurricular activities and sort of know what's generally what's good for college.
Yeah.
Or even if they don't know what's good for college, they've been very active outside the classroom. There's more of a culture of that at least among the people who come to us.
Mm-hmm.
There are certainly a lot of Indian schools with very few extracurricular activities, and we work with families to build a profile like that. But in Vietnam, our Vietnamese students will have a much lower, much less involved extracurricular profile.
Sure.
Expectations of families are also pretty different. In Vietnam, basically they expect a little more hand-holding through the whole process and a more rigid structure to things, whereas Indian families are very happy with a more informal guidance and advice when necessary.
Okay. Now, I know Indian families are probably very deeply involved to the point of micromanaging the process. How are the Vietnamese families, our parents?
Well, they will, look for a counselor that they trust, and they will. It's really the premise of your question. I'll challenge the premise of your question. We have a wide range of parent involvement. I had a parent who wanted to meet with me and not even have the kid, meet with me.
Yeah.
Because the kid was busy, and I told him that's not really how we do things.
Right.
It ended up being that I basically caught the. Once I did meet with the kid, found out that the parent had actually been writing his essays. and I pointed that out that we can't really have that. And actually the family left. They just stopped communicating.
Sure.
They didn't ask for a refund or anything, but the father actually stopped communicating. is one of the very rare times we've had somebody withdraw from from consultation. But that was sort of an extreme example where he was doing all of the school selection and planning and even the essay writing and application. And that was something that I ethically couldn't stand for.
Yeah, totally understandable. How do you guys kind of set expectations with parents and students? I mean, the student shows up, says, or the parents, depending students and parents, they have some kind of a dream school or targets, or I'm guessing in some cases, no idea. Maybe that's a good place to start. How often do people show up saying they don't know what to do versus very, very clear about where they want to go? Obviously then work out the process. So where do students do normally come in?
It's usually in between.
Yeah.
It's usually in between. They'll have a few schools they think they want to go to.
Mm-hmm.
But what we have, you know, what often, and this is one of the challenges, a lot of families come to us with unable to afford a full college education.
Yeah.
Most families in the United States, vast majority, can't afford a full college education.
Yeah.
And of course, there's financial aid available. A lot of parents want to have their child get into the best possible school,
right,
but also get financial aid and lower the cost.
Right.
So finding the right balance of schools to apply to, some of which would offer financial aid, some of which would not.
Yeah.
As many of your listeners may know, the vast majority of schools applying for any financial aid reduces your chances of getting in.
Yes.
So finding the right balance is tough. And so we occasionally, a family with financial aid will say, hey, I really want to go to Carnegie Mellon University or UC Berkeley. Uh-huh. Well, guess what? UC Berkeley, Carnegie Mellon don't offer any kind of financial aid or scholarship whatsoever.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I have to manage their expectations with those kinds of schools. We definitely have a range of families that, some have a list. Here's a list of schools, we want to apply to. Generally though, that's not a finalized list and they're open to suggestions from us.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Then I'm assuming they come in with what might be an initial list, but then obviously you are going to validate it in some way before go forward with something or, change or provide better options, as the case may be. I did notice on your site that, in your testimonials that there are lots of students with scholarships and financial aid. So you are working pretty aggressively to help students find the money, right? It looks like.
Yeah, that's right. So so students often want to know, are there scholarships that I can apply to? For most countries, there are really not external scholarships.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really help with external scholarships. The scholarships that are provided are given by the universities themselves.
Got it. Now, from a admissions point of view, a big change that I noticed was that a lot of universities have gone test optional, standardized test optional. So that's going to change the equation somewhat in their admissions process, right? At least the requirements process.
Yes.
So how do you see that changing in the actual applications of students?
Sure. Well, you may want to ask some of your colleagues who are in admissions, currently, but I don't think they've thought this through. I think that this was a premature, not necessarily a premature decision, but a decision that I think that colleges and the administrations don't really appreciate the consequences of. There are a lot of test optional colleges, but there are not a lot of test optional colleges for international students. And I'm speaking with respect to international students.
Yeah.
It's true in general.
Yeah.
But it's certainly with respect to international students, there's just such a range of high school curricula and high school policies and behaviors and grading habits. And there's just so many different things that it's really the only way to truly compare international students to one another is standardized test scores.
Right.
The only fair way.
Yeah.
And so right now we're left with a sort of a void in the ability to compare students to see how well college prepared they are. Because even though the SAT and ACT are not perfect tests by any stretch, they are rough. You know, the colleges have relied on them and do rely on them for, you know, for telling whether students are prepared for college. And I know you had sent me a list of questions before, and one of the main things that the main things in admissions that families should think about is, how do I demonstrate that I'm ready for college?
Yeah.
That's what a student should. How do I demonstrate that I'd be ready for college? That's why APs help. That's why standardized tests help. That's why IB students have an advantage. You know, that's why playing sports that are offered on college campuses can help. You know, can help that you're ready for college and you're ready for the academically and for campus life. That's why summer programs in the U.S. can help. Not necessarily because of the name, but because you're prepared for a college campus experience. So there are many fewer metrics to tell whether students are ready for college.
So I think what you're basically saying is that it may end up not being a permanent thing, a temporary thing, just because of the situation that a couple of years.
I don't see it being feasible. Yeah. I don't see.
Yeah.
I think that colleges are going to track, and they have ways to track to see, you know, how students with you know, how grades are, you know, colleges, it's a little imperfect because there's, you know, curves and things, but colleges do track these things, and they correlate test scores with grades, and they correlate high school GPAs with grades.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to see how students do, you know, in a few years. My feeling is that colleges are going to want to go back to testing.
Okay. I mean, fair enough.
That's Not all colleges. University of California has been very bold.
Yes.
I think that for international students, I think they're going to have a lot of trouble identifying international students who are college ready.
Okay. So switching gears a little bit, I want to talk about the present. So here we are in the midst of COVID-19. Have you seen any impact to counseling, college-going kids? I mean, what's the state of mind, do you think?
Sure. So there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah.
That's the one certainty, is that there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yes.
And colleges, and especially parents, and actually the COVID pandemic occurred at a very interesting time for admissions,
uh-huh,
where it is not going to affect the admissions cycle very much.
Yes.
It's going to affect the enrollment cycle a lot.
Got it.
But the admissions are not going to work so much differently. The admissions were already done. By the time the pandemic was recognized and things were shutting down, admissions were basically done.
Right.
Now, how to manage what happens now, that's a different question. And we're helping our families do that, especially with a new development yesterday for your listeners.
Yes.
That students attending online universities, online programs, that are online programs that are online only anyway, high schools included, these applies to high school students, will have to leave the country if they're already in the U.S. and won't be allowed into the U.S. So that's causing a lot of angst right now, because a lot of colleges haven't announced, really. Colleges have only recently started announcing what they're going to do. So there's a lot of uncertainty with that, with enrollment. We're helping our families that we've been working with through that.
So if I can stop
that's one
you,
thing.
Yeah, if yeah, I can sure. stop you right there and ask that next question, I mean, just to follow up on that, what is the general, with the students who were admitted and who are all teed up to attend a college or the other, how are they reviewing or viewing that process? I mean, do they want to come in fall 2020, or do they want to take a gap year or defer it, or what's happening with those kids, you think?
So most families, most students who have gotten into school want to start school already.
Okay.
They want to start school, but the prospect of online classes where you're in a totally different time zone, you know, if you're attending live online classes, that's really not so feasible. If you're in Vietnam, which is 11 hours ahead,
yeah,
or even
yeah.
India, which is 9.5 hours ahead.
Yeah.
It's very difficult. So, I've been encouraging, and students have been taking deferrals. Well, right now, colleges haven't really announced yet,
yes,
so they haven't really had to respond. But I've been encouraging deferral where possible. you know, to defer where possible, because you don't really want to be paying all that money for just an online education. And if you have the option, then you should take it. Now, what to do during that time is a different story. You know, during a gap year, travel is usually very popular, but you know, not as feasible this year. But I'm not encouraging students to enroll in online courses as long as they have the option. And most, and I anticipate that most colleges will give an option for deferral.
Okay, so that sounds fair. Okay, so so just thinking ahead now, is this sort of impacting students who want to apply for the 2021 fall, the rising seniors right now? I mean, how do you see their view changing about applying to U.S. colleges, or do you think this will pass and they are all betting on this thing behind us, COVID-19 being behind us?
Sure. And I think we're seeing that families that would have been sort of set on the U.S. are exploring more options.
Okay.
Demand for U.S. I don't think has gone down, but certainly exploring other options has gone up.
Okay.
Whereas it would sort of been a foregone conclusion that a student would go to the U.S. Now, you know, Canada, staying in India, Singapore, Hong Kong, you know, other places that might, you know, have controlled COVID better and might be open to international travel. Honestly, it's that uncertainty with, you know, will the U.S., you know, be able to, you know, get the pandemic under control, and will international travel even be, you know, allowed, and will campuses be open in fall 2021? I didn't think that would be a question. A month ago, I did not think that would be a question. The U.S. was heading in the right direction with COVID.
Yeah.
COVID cases, but in the past month we've you know, been increasing. Now even if deaths are not increasing, and you know, a lot of the results are because of increased testing, we're still seeing, you know, not as positive results in many parts of the US as other countries have, you know, have gotten things under control. So I think there is more uncertainty now this month than there even was a month ago.
So how do you think colleges are retooling? I mean, not just for COVID. I mean, it sounds like there are some changes that are likely to be permanent from all the stuff that I'm reading or at least listening to. So what is your sense of, you know, is it going to change? Obviously, there will be changes, but how is it likely to impact international students? Is there, or maybe is it just going to be temporary? What's your kind of gut feel about it?
Sure. So college, you know, the American college experience is almost uniquely vulnerable to this kind of pandemic. Now, as it happened that, you know, colleges were able to send their students home and have, you know, minimal disruption to their, you know, to their year, because it happened so late in the semester.
Right.
I have a few thoughts on this. One, you know, the American college campus experience is, you know, has been part of American culture for a very long time.
Absolutely.
And there's a more emphasis on the community, on the cohabitation of students, you know, students who live in dorms together and do not just go to class together, but eat together and do extracurricular activities. The reason extracurricular activities are so valued by universities is not just that they want students to jump through hoops. Yeah. They want students who are going to be involved on campus, active on campus.
Yeah.
That's why they like extracurricular activities, because extracurricular activities are such an important part of college culture.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of culture is especially vulnerable to orders, the stay-at-home orders, and when people's health is at risk, you know, any attempt to mitigate, you know, mitigate people being together is going to compromise the college experience.
Got it.
So you know, the question of, you know, of how it's going to be affected, you know, as long as, you know, the college experience is going to be affected a lot. Based on or on the basis of any kind of pandemic response, certainly. Now, the question of whether this is permanent or people, you know, want to go back to normal, I'm seeing in the United States, another part of the United States culture is freedom.
Yes.
Now, there's, you know, there's been a trend, and one of the reasons that the United States has not been able to contain the virus is that people just want to go about their lives as usual.
Yes.
Now, the question is, are universities, you know, are universities going to indulge that, or will they not? And I think there are a lot of unanswered questions where students may want to assume the risk and families may want to assume the risk, but professors may not want to assume the risk.
That's right.
And there was an article in the New York Times this week about professors who were protesting schools' decisions to reopen.
Yeah, and especially in Georgia, I think, where face masks are optional and stuff like that. So,
fortunately, colleges can set their own, policies on campus.
Yeah,
but yes, there were the places where there might be a more rapid spread. I can certainly understand why professors, especially older professors, would be very concerned.
Right. Right. The average age of the professors is like 55 or something. That's what they
were saying. They said that the article said that the average age of a tenured professor is over 55.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's like 5,000 different decisions as far as colleges go, because sure, each one's going to make their own. Cool. So before we close out on this particular podcast, I mean, there's so much to talk about.
And sure, of course.
I think we should continue to have conversations on this. I just wanted to give you a chance to sort of talk about the sweet spot. What are the kinds of opportunities you're looking for? What is Ivy achievement sort of best suited for the audience? And, whatever you think, whatever else that you think may make sense to tell them.
Sure. So we primarily help students, families, and students who want to get into competitive universities. We're not an agency we're not paid by universities to place students. We don't get paid for placements. Mm-hmm. We really have an interest that's aligned with the families to get into the best possible program for the student, mm-hmm. And to try to get into a program that's affordable for the family.
Sure.
So we're working with students who are looking for, roughly in the top 100 schools in, say the U.S. News rankings or, those, mm-hmm. not necessarily that particular ranking, but, generally recognized as the competitive schools in the United States.
Sure.
With admissions rates, 50% and below. Now, we definitely specialize in helping students who are at, are looking for Ivy in the top, the very top schools. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of experience with that. I attended two Ivy League colleges. Many of our writing specialists are Ivy educated. Mm-hmm. It's not the only criterion, but going to an elite school does help in getting hired as a specialist for Ivy achievement.
Absolutely.
So of course it's in the name, Ivy achievement. So we can add, I think we can add the most value for those kinds of families who are, who are seeking the top levels. However, we do help families, apply to a range of colleges, and students apply to a range of colleges, and very often, even if they get into a higher ranked college, very often it's appropriate to go to a lower ranked one that's more affordable. And so we also help identify those opportunities.
Very good. Very good. So, Ben, this has been very insightful and helpful. I think I got a good feel for personally for your business, and I see a lot of passion. You gave up a law career to do this. So
I wouldn't consider a big sacrifice, honestly. That's not a big sacrifice. You'll meet very few former lawyers who regret their decision to leave law. I don't know one. Okay. There are a lot of former lawyers out there.
Okay.
But I do like sometimes the interrogation, and my interview process is derived from how lawyers interview witnesses.
Yeah.
And I find it's actually very effective. It's a lot of fun. Sometimes intimidating.
I know.
I have a lot of stories, but now is not the time.
Very good. So on that note, I'd like to thank you for joining me on this podcast. I think it's been great, and hopefully we'll have a lot more conversations in the future. Thank you so much,
Ben. Thank you for this opportunity, Venkat.
Sure thing. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi again. Hope you enjoyed our podcast with Ben Stern of Ivy Achievement. I was particularly struck by Ben's commitment to understanding his students and their families in India and Vietnam. His passion to guide students to the best possible colleges comes through. For your questions or comments on this podcast, please email counselors@almamatters.io. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast today. Transcripts for this podcast and previous podcasts are on almamatters.io/podcasts. To stay connected with us, subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify, or visit anchor.fm/almamatters to check us out. Till we meet again, take care and be safe. Thank you.